Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show for Saturday, September 7th, 2013. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and our topic for today is the Nuclear Thermonuclear North American Water and Power Alliance 21, the New Economy. Now, I'm very glad we have two people with us here in the studio who are part of the team who produced a new report on this topic area that literally has just been posted and made available in the last 48 hours by it's a special report by the 21st Century Science and Technology magazine, and it's otherwise you can link to it in many places. I'll mention this. But first, I want to welcome the two people who are part of the team that produced this, Leona Fansheng. Welcome, Leona.
Hi, Marcia. Thank you.
And also, we have Michael Kirsch. Welcome, Michael.
Hey, good to be here. Thanks a lot.
And so, this is more than timely. This is an historical intervention. Because let me just say a few things about the current situation, then I'll turn it over to Michael to kick off their discussion of the report as a whole and the whole area in intervention. But what we're involved in right now, everyone, is a showdown process. It's a matter of survival. We have a faction. You've seen the headlines. You know what's taking place about the danger of instigating intervention in Syria with military action that can kick off the world war and the end of humanity. This is insane. But this faction who would want to do this, they're working through President Obama, as you can see, who's just in service to them, is part of, has a lineage that goes back centuries that's really an imperial kind of operation, international, centered, you could say, in London. You see this in the royals, the current Queen of England, her consort, who are anti-humanity. That's not our topic today, but they're not rational. They are venal. And you wonder how insane could people be to want to endanger the human race. But you see an expression of the same character that would endanger the human race with this literal war. Also in the kind of environmentalist green cult of recent decades that says that human beings are overwhelming the planet. It's human beings that are polluting nature. Crazy stuff like that. So we, not to give a whole detailed update on the current picture, we have a situation where this faction, this element of opposition to humanity is actually part of the collapsed financial system we've had of mega banking protected by bailouts and now trying to regroup through something they politely called bail-in, which just means screw you, a few of us are going to survive and we're going to destroy the means of existence of other people. But this kind of crowd, it's not guaranteed that they're going to succeed. We have many events of the hour, which we're not proceeding from events, but that shows the opposition to this, shows the potential to stop this kind of thing. And I want to mention a few of those developments in recent days and what's coming ahead, because most of you listening in, if you're regulars, you're involved in the fight. And if you're just listening in occasionally or for the first time, you need to know. Now, let me just get specific here briefly. We've had in Washington, D.C., Congress as a whole is returning September 9th and 10th. Over 150 of them were in Washington at different times in recent days because, you know, up to a third of the House of Representatives, for example, signed letters saying Obama better not intervene militarily in Syria unilaterally without discussing this with Congress, who has the constitutional authority to make such a decision. So Congress has already expressed itself in that fashion. But now, and it was a week ago where President Obama gave some lip service to saying, okay, I'll wait. But in fact, things are on the edge, and it's been the activation around the United States internationally, but I'm going to take the United States, of people intervening in local congressional districts institutionally and in other ways, saying we don't want the White House to take unilateral action. We don't want military action approved at all anyway. And so you're seeing a political expression of an impulse to leadership and a revulsion against this imperial crowd that is can make all the difference in the world. And Mr. LaRouche himself, who's been issuing statements, conferring with people, he conferred with Leona Michel and other people, including members of the National Policy Committee of the LaRouche Political Action Committee this morning. They're in town from around the country. Mr. LaRouche is celebrating his 91st birthday this weekend, so he's keeping very busy leading this fight. And I'm mentioning this because we have other people that you've seen. I'm just giving a kind of update on the fight, speaking out around the world, including on specifics that will make a very great deal of difference. For example, take what's become an emblem of collapse, the city of Detroit, that once had in its metro area, I think, at least 1.5 million people in the 1950s. It's now down to 700,000. And it's been in a forced bankruptcy process by Wall Street. And on Friday, that was yesterday, the 6th of September, the City of Detroit School Board passed a resolution in favor of reinstating Glass-Steagall nationally. And this is just indication of the institutional and individual and state and local action that's being mobilized by the LaRouche Political Action Committee and people who are leading the charge in Washington, D.C. So those are just a few of the developments. You know, you'll have in 3 days, the White House has announced President Obama is going to address the nation. That would be on Tuesday, the 10th. And he's on this war path on behalf of the British imperial war crowd. So we are in a fighting moment, and I wanted to indicate some of the elements of that, because this brings us to the importance of the work that Michael Kirsch is going to describe, and in particular to the nature of the crisis we're in, even if in specific Obama and a particular London, let's call it the Tony Blair imperial crowd, wasn't going to say we want to fire on Syria and instigate war tomorrow. Even if they didn't, we're in a collapse process with this, which threatens the survival of the United States and of the human race on this planet. Now, Michael, you were going to start with some of the character or the symptoms of the situation.
Yeah, well, I'll just say something provocative, that every single crisis we face today is because of a lack of attention to the Kennedy direction 40 years ago. There's not one single crisis that people are feeling, water, food, jobs, infrastructure, and even this global conflict that you just described, that's not located in the failure to continue the Kennedy technological direction. And if we had a government that was committed to continuing this direction that Kennedy had, we would have thrown Obama out a long time ago. And so there would be no international crisis, as you describe, with what the Saudis and the British have done in creating this whole 9/11 era. We would have a government that would have an executive committed intentionally to evolve the human species and evolve the economy. And our report, Nuclear Nawapa 21, Gateway to the Fusion Economy, it redefines that evolutionary trend. Now, today, I want to discuss with you the section of the report that I chiefly wrote, the Nuclear Nawapa 21 and the New Economy, and Leona Fanchang will be discussing her section, Nuclear Agro-Industrial Complexes for Nawapa 21. But, you know, just briefly, that it is, yes, all of the symptoms that people face are all solved by evolving the economy, because economy is not something that can be separated into parts. It's an integrated process, and as a whole it evolves, or as a whole it degrades. You can't have a breakthrough in water that then doesn't have a breakthrough in infrastructure or industry. Any collapse of agriculture affects the entire rest of the economy. Any new infrastructural grid that you'd create for water would transform energy, and any breakthrough in the energy system would transform the water system. And I can give some very detailed examples of that today. But this is this direction of evolving the economy, which will solve all of so-called symptoms by getting at the cause of the crisis, not the symptoms, is really the thrust of our report.
And the other thing is it also addresses even the a lot of what you brought up, Marcia, on the whole insanity around the Syria situation, this really the threat of thermonuclear war. And the way that Mr. LaRouche put it just a few weeks ago was you've got the thermonuclear option. And really, you've got the thermonuclear options, because we had and still have an opportunity to develop a fusion economy and organize the entire world around an upshift of the entire economy. Instead, what Obama and others are playing with is thermonuclear war, which would do the opposite. Would annihilate annihilate human society. So what we really started this report out with was, okay, how do we define what, can we lay out a perspective for the next four generations? Can we lay out a perspective for the next four generations, which would in turn then define a credit system? It would define then how you create the institutions about, or how you would reorganize the current economy. You have to have because we all know you have to have a vision. You have to have somewhere you're going to be able to define what you're doing now. And this is the basis for the inspiration for the report. One, this idea of defining a four-generation outlook, but then also a provocation by Mr. LaRouche around this idea of a thermonuclear NWAPA, a fusion-driven economic development process, which will be, which will include a lot. Will include one, a full embrace of the directionality we were taking now 40 years ago on nuclear power, nuclear processes. So this includes not just nuclear power in the way that we know it now, which is basically nuclear fission used to produce heat, which is then used to boil water and basically run a steam engine.
For it to bring off the electricity that way.
Right, and then to get electricity, which has an inherent loss factor, a 70%, sometimes less, but around a 70% loss. So not just to use nuclear power, which we do need, but to use the heat that is actually generated for industrial processes, which use a lot of heat, to desalinate water, but then also to use the nuclear products, the fission products, which we now just bury in some landfill, but are actually very, very valuable products. And basically create the type of economy that is equivalent to the shift. That the shift from now to a nuclear economy would be equivalent to the shift that occurred from a coal economy to a petroleum one, where in that shift, for example, you're really shifting not just for you're not just using a different energy source, but you're taking on the entire chemistry domain, the power to manipulate materials on the chemical domain. And so we want to be able to have that have that type of flexibility with the entire nuclear domain. And this will have both the small and the large implications.
Let me ask you one thing, Liana, just because reading the whole report, and let me interpose here, I may not have said earlier, this is about 60 pages, it's a must-have. You can go on LaRouchePack.com and link onto it. It's being printed. I hear a rumor the initial run might be 5,000 or 10,000 copies. But let me get to the content of what you just said. I'm just urging everyone on who listens to this program to make sure they have this, subscribe to 21st Century Science, do all that. When you said about the kind of upshift, the nature of it, I was thinking of an historical example that's more along the lines of the time period of Hamilton that Michael Kirsch talks about. But when I once read some of Thomas Jefferson's letters, and when he happened to personally visit London or otherwise have a special report from London, it was on a steam engine that they had on display in London. I think they had it connected to a grist mill. It was doing some work. And the letter's amazing because he said, well, we're hearing a lot about this steam engine and how it could revolutionize things. But in my view, the only thing it's good for is repetitive motion. Mm-hmm. And so it would be good for things on the farm, like churning butter. You can picture the repetitive motion. For sure he didn't get it. And this isn't maybe the time and place, but he was on the right side, but he really was helped by, when he wasn't helped by George Washington and Benjamin Franklin, I think he went astray. But that's an example, right, of what you're saying, Liana.
Yes.
Of he couldn't see what actually came to pass. The steam engine did replace horsepower, right?
Yeah, well, it's actually something that Michael mentioned just earlier, is that you know when you're in a new economy, when technological advances are able to be fully assimilated. And so, for example, something that is in the report is some of the newest technologies in plasma technology and laser technology and so on, which have been around and are being worked on in some way in industrial processes, but have not been assimilated in full into the economy, and largely because we have a different economy. We don't have an economy which can assimilate it. And so you could have these, like, for example, if somebody were to discover or to successfully hold a controlled fusion reaction right now, that doesn't mean that the entire economy is going to change necessarily. You have to have, and this is what we want to discuss today, is this idea of a new economy. You can have an anomaly within a sort of arcane economy, and all it will be is an anomaly. Mm-hmm. It'll be something
churn
like
butter.
A circus, churn butter, yeah. Or something that's something you put on display. But you have to prepare the economy to be able to provide a foundation, basically. And that's what the nuclear economy is about, relative to a fusion economy, which is sort of the theme we took up, a gateway to the fusion economy.
Yeah, also, you can't evolve unless you know where you're evolving to. Evolution doesn't occur as random mechanical interactions of atoms to then other complex organisms and so forth. And that's why, so you have to know what the directionality is where you're going. There's two elements, I think, that we really capture in this report, which is one, the breakthrough of energy flux density controlled fusion of atoms, of nuclei, to create virtually free energy for mankind. But the second is the directionality of how we're going to control the resources of the biosphere as a whole. Can we shape the structure of the planet as far as our weather system goes? Can we, in the long term, by biospheric engineering, creating this continental water management system and the corridor of development that we need to create? This is where you're evolving toward, a new backbone across the planet to China, where we're going to have a rail system that's not, you're not going up and down around the Pacific, you're going straight to China, if you look at it on a globe. And that will be a new backbone for the world, where we can apply the newest, highest technologies there, and we can have this cooperation agreements and industry going back and forth and applying all these new nuclear technologies, mining technologies, Northern Arctic rail technologies that are being developed right now in Siberia, and so forth. These are the direction. This is the direction to where we're evolving. But now, what Leona just said, this is something that you can't do. You can't just say, well, here's our end goal. How are you going to get there? And the economy as a whole has to accept the technologies that exist and have existed for a long time, fission, as a process throughout. And, you know, you didn't have – it's as though today if we weren't driving cars, or it's as though in the 1920s we weren't driving cars. We were still using horse and buggies even though we had the petroleum. It's as though we didn't create the combustion engine with petroleum. That's where we are right now, not using the process heat from available with fission, not using the plasma magnetohydrodynamics, which we can describe a bit more, for all throughout any reactor system, not extracting the electricity there. It's as though, and not applying fission for the creation of water and desalination through every major coastal city and so forth. So the process of this evolution is immediately to apply fission throughout and to draw then on the latest, all the breakthroughs that could be possible in plasma industry and to then move toward the fusion economy. So the phase is we have to go high gear working with countries that currently are the depositories of the technology. China, Japan, South Korea, are, unfortunately for us, we've been missing out on the concentrated skill of a workforce and scientific relation. When you have an industry that's applying a technology, you're the beneficiary throughout your economy of that new technology. We've exported a lot of this, and we are going to have to work with these countries to figure out a way to mass produce the most advanced generation reactors that are being produced right now, while we're keeping an eye on the future, but mass produce them here. We have a huge energy deficit right now. We should almost be doubling in the next 10 years, but immediately we have to create a good 20, 28, 30, 40 new nuclear reactors just to have the energy capacity in the United States to start mass producing things here for NWAPA 21, and for a complete revamping of our whole infrastructure grid, which is totally collapsed. That will mean, therefore, that we have to retool our auto sectors. In 2005, Executive Intelligence Review put forward a map of 64 auto plants. Most of them are gone. Almost all of them are gone. But there are some places where we can retool auto capacity to then mass-produce plants here. But immediately we'll have to work with China, Russia, South Korea, Japan on getting all the different elements for a nuclear reactor. We don't create pressure vessels here. We couldn't do it.
The other aspect, don't forget, is also the skill, the skilled labor, which would be part of this first phase.
That's the other problem. Right now, the Tennessee Valley is producing one nuclear reactor. They're completing it. And Executive Intelligence Review did an interview with the head of the TVA, and they said that the only reason they weren't doing two is that the skilled labor didn't exist, and the parts suppliers didn't exist for them to do two at once. So the skill, building up the skill, building up the mass production process, getting it in assembly line fashion, and immediately then applying through a government authority that will be set apart for this, massive desalination, 42 desalination locations I propose, based on rivers desalination, agricultural wastewater reprocessing, and coastal. And we can immediately halt the water crisis for a vast part of our country. And we can mitigate that right away and apply it. Every one of these places will also be set up for something that Leona can go through more in depth, industrial process heat. Now, that'll be going while we're making a treaty with China and Canada and Mexico. We can. It's undetermined when that treaty will be signed, but this year they're renegotiating the Columbia River Treaty. It's not too late if we get Obama out and get this paradigm shift we need as far as Congress is concerned and what they see as possible to enact in that discussion of the Columbia River a broader discussion on the entire continental water system. But however many years that takes, while that discussion is underway, we can be mass producing these nuclear plants here and rebuilding our rail system to start moving the supplies out to the western regions of NWAPA 21. And so we have a nuclear authority. We'll have a NWAPA 21 authority when the treaty gets signed. And we'll be integrating, as the most advanced technologies are available, into the process associated with fusion power, whatever we can bring in for that, limited fusion reactions inside fourth-generation reactors, or I should say limited fusion reactors, then creating new fuel that we could create. And using everywhere, if we have the intention of where we're evolving, that means that we'll be applying new technologies throughout the industrial and infrastructure process while we're moving toward our goal. And it's going to be a few years of building up that skilled labor, but whatever we can do in building up an initial run of nuclear power plants, mass-produced. We have 28 brownfield sites where there's already a spot for a reactor around the country.
You mean out of the 100, of them are shutting down. There is room for two or three more.
There were 100 canceled. We should have had 200 by the mid-70s.
Right.
There was 100 canceled. We should have had 200 by the mid-80s. Now we only have 100. There were 100 of those canceled in the 70s. And 17 locations have room for 28. So we can immediately produce those, the desalination. So everything we build up as far as our capacity will then be applied to the construction of NWAPA 21 at a much higher level, a higher concentration span of the workforce, skilled labor, and a new international system. So it's going to be a completely new economy. You can't think of – you're not bringing water in. You're not just creating power for an existing economy. By doing this, we'll have created – we'll look in hindsight. We won't recognize our ancestors. Like the mammals look back at the reptiles and said, who are those guys? I wouldn't want to have dinner with them. They eat too slow. Anyway, so I think that looking at then what it is that each of these nuclear plants we're going to build, I can say more on the resumption of the Kennedy program for desalination and also then along how that will integrate with the NWAPA routes, which will be corridors of development. At each of these places will be geared to make even more physically efficient, and this is the sense of the credit system, by incorporating what John F. Kennedy's program in 1962 was, which was to use the high-temperature gas-cooled reactor that had actually been shut down in 61. They had dropped the program. Kennedy relaunched it, and then there was a massive research by Oak Ridge National Laboratory and other places to fully integrate industry with nuclear energy. And agriculture, creating an increasingly integrated economy with this new principle that would be throughout. So it's not something separate over here. That would make everything more efficient for NWAPA 21, for everything that we need to build for that and the rest of it. So I thought it'd be good, I don't know if you want to say more now, on agro-industrial nuclear power.
Sure, yeah. I had read through a few things, several articles in previously published in Fusion Magazine, and then some of the original articles that were or studies published by Oak Ridge National Laboratories back in the 60s. So this is mid to late 60s. They did a full study on building what they called nuplexes, which were these nuclear agro-industrial complexes. Integrated complexes which would be centered around several nuclear reactors, which would provide the usual electricity, but it would also provide heat, which industry uses a lot of at high temperatures, and then also to be used for desalinating water. So in that way, You would build an industrial base, a sort of a powerhouse of production right around the nuclear power plants. And there would be direct heat exchangers that would take nuclear heat to industries, which then, of course, cut down a lot on the 70% loss factor you get with converting heat to then boil water, to then create steam, to then turn a turbine, and then generate electricity.
Cool it down in water, I guess.
Yes, and then cool it down again, generate electricity. And, of course, the other aspect is that because that electricity doesn't do all of what industry needs, industry right now uses a lot of coal. A lot of coal, a lot of petroleum to generate the heat they need. For example, in Nawapa, we're going to have to produce a lot of steel, cement, some basic industrial processes, a lot of which in the United States is very weak. We produce not nearly as much as we did before, but two, not nearly enough for Nawapa. And that type of stuff, that type of industrial process actually is going to require a huge attention on being able to produce a lot just being able to produce a lot. And so this idea of integrating the process of the nuclear power and then directly into an industrial base that then is plugged into an agricultural area, which takes that electricity, takes that water, takes the fertilizers being produced in this industrial unit, and so on, and uses that for the highest technology and most food-dense areas is what we developed here in this report, and it will also this idea of creating these sort of industrial cities, these integrated cities, one, it will push the requirement for our nuclear power plants to be generation four, because our current nuclear power plants, the ones we have hundreds of, or less, in the world,
400 maybe.
Right. Those can only go up to about 500 degrees Celsius. Generation 4 reactors go to up 1,000. And that will cover coal processing, will cover a large portion of cement manufacturing. It doesn't cover it all. And we'll have to make some major technological advances to get to the steel temperatures. It will drive a lot of the nuclear technology. But then, two, we'll be able to have these units to then, you sort of plop down in places to locate them, for example, in the Great Lakes region where there's raw materials, and you could have one of these industrial areas right there. But then really along the entire corridor that's generated by Nawapa and the Bering Strait and sort of this Pacific Rim area, you would want to put these areas of high development and high productivity along this whole route. And then
I'll just jump in. It's exciting when you look at the map. When you look at the map, in the section that I wrote for the desalination locations, you could see that if we build these plants to be both using the low temperature process heat for desalination and the high temperature, which she was saying fourth generation gives you, not only with the high temperature gas cooled reactor, they were looking at higher efficiencies of generating electricity, but then having a much higher temperature process heat. If you look at the map that we have in a report on page 29 of the locations of 42 desalination plants, you can see that some of the areas out in the west where we're building this, in the Rio Grande Basin, the Colorado Basin, and the High Plains, well, if we build these nuclear power plants right now to desalinate agricultural wastewater, nitrate contamination, there's a lot of groundwater that we could be using for agriculture and other needs that can't be pumped because it's too salted or where salt traps have been created through groundwater pumping and also contaminated with nitrate all throughout the Central Valley, all throughout the High Plains. And all these rivers in the West, Colorado River and Salt River, Rio Grande, we could be running that water through a desalination plant and then not only concentrating the sodium chloride, magnesium chloride for fertilizer and magnesium sulfate, but then we could be putting that new fresh water back in the river for higher agricultural yields. Well, this is all a tangent to say that these plants could also be producing industry and manufacturing. We could be using these plants as little nucleus centers to build up new industries in the area so we can then deliver the parts for infrastructure, big earth-moving machines, and for cement and steel that we're going to need in the areas then that we're actually going to be building the project 5, 6, 7 years after these nuclear power plants are built. So you get a sense of how this future state will determine the present locations of these plants where we decide to put them. But the other big thing is going to be industrializing our so-called industrial heartland with a new industrial platform in Detroit, St. Louis, Cincinnati, these places. And I think it would be really good for you to give to tell people how this process heat is actually funneled from the reactor process in your article.
Yeah, well, let me just bring up one thing before I go into that, which is that, you know, there's the case of the Tennessee Valley Authority that where when we built that area up with dams, it also became the foundation or the backbone of supporting research on nuclear power and nuclear processes. And I think that's going to be an important factor with in determining where we put these things and what we put around them, what we put around these industrial centers, because we want to be continually looking forward. And, for example, ideally you would want these industrial centers to be surrounded by research institutes, which would be looking into plasma technology, looking into superconductivity, basically looking into the factors of fusion, the components that are required for a fusion economy. But yeah, if you want to look at this process heat idea, I mean, it's not incredibly complex. Basically, right now, the way that we produce, the only benefit that we get out of nuclear reactors is, at least in the United States, is we take heat that is generated by an amazing process, actually, of fission, right? So you're talking about splitting atoms into two other atoms, not into trash, not into ash, but into two other atoms which are going to be useful, and then taking that heat, siphoning it off, and then creating a boiling water with it. And so you're just imagining yourself at home in front of a pot of water, boiling water, and this is what you're using this amazing process for, is boiling water, and then the steam goes through a turbine, which then generates electricity, your regular old electricity. And this is generally what we use it for now. Now, the heat that's coming out of nuclear reactors is about, you know, 500 to 1,000 degrees, depending on what kind of nuclear reactor you're using. And it could be more. It actually could be more, just depending on, you know, what kind of materials you're using to contain it and so on. Obviously, you know that our first the first public experience with nuclear reactions was a bomb. And so that's the limit of heat it could produce. Now, we were able to control it. and that's how we created energy from it. But it has a capability to produce high amounts of heat, and we have an ability to use that for direct processing of coal, of water, of fertilizers, of cement, of steel. And give an example, cement uses temperatures up to 1400 degrees Celsius. It's pretty high. Steel uses up to, you know, about 2000 degrees, a little less, depending on the amount of coal that's in the steel, or it's in the iron. And so you're dealing with something that, you're dealing with temperature requirements which currently require a very old, low energy dense fuel, coal, petroleum, and replacing that basically with a much more energy dense form of fuel. And I'll just give you a good example. You know, we use a billion tons of coal a year. So if you've ever been stopped, and I used this example in the article too, but if you've ever been late to something because of
a unit train, right?
A train, right? You've seen these coal trains, and there's never just a couple. There's a huge line of these trains, of these
cars, yeah.
Of these cars filled with coal. And that's our current energy source, especially in the United States, for producing large amounts of heat. Besides electricity, they also produce electricity. In fact, our desalination plants in the United States are actually powered by coal. So you see, you start to see how old the foundational process is. If you look at the comparison, like for example, for 1 pound of coal, it produces about 3.8 kilowatt hours of energy. Whereas 1 pound of uranium would produce 18,000, about 19,000 kilowatt hours. So you see there's several orders of magnitude difference between coal and uranium. Now it's not just the energy you're dealing with though, the energy density. And there's also the amount of infrastructure you're using, right? So all those trains, roads, and so on, the amount of skilled labor that is required in all of this huge process, and also what quality of skilled labor you're dealing with. Are you dealing with nuclear engineers, or are you dealing with lots of miners? Which I'm not saying that's not bad. That's not a bad thing.
No, it's whose lives are threatened because...
Whose lives are threatened,
because
yeah.
of this retrograde mode.
Right, exactly. Did you want to say something?
No, that's fine. We should go on to this next part.
What I'm trying to paint in this article, and I think we're going to come out with a lot more in this near future to fill out this picture, is that, you know, in order to prepare for a fusion economy, we're going to need a lot. We need production. We need high amounts of material. We need skilled labor. We need educational centers and so on. And part of the preparation for a fusion economy is, as Michael said, a concentration on the fission economy and the fission nuclear economy. And one of the aspects of it is to take full control over fission products. And this includes, right, like for example, right now we use mostly, we use those fission products mostly as radioisotopes. And they're not even mostly produced here, actually.
I hear we're always getting short and freaking out.
Yeah.
Well, the Obama administration is apparently demanding that we produce now our molybdenum. without using nuclear energy.
Right, without using nuclear. So now, yes. So now there's a laboratory, there's a huge investment in this laboratory process of trying to create molybdenum without nuclear.
And this is just, I mean, this is just, so do people, I mean, do people realize that you can create with a nuclear reactor any, all these elements that you want? Because you're splitting a high a high atomic number element, 235, and splitting it then up into virtually every possible element below that. There's various ways in which you can hone that in to get what you want. But I mean, do people realize that? How many people understand that these plants are also production factories of isotopes that we need all for everyday life and for things now that we use to create a much higher standard of living throughout medical systems? So you're creating these systems which are mass-producing high-temperature process heat, mass-producing isotopes of all kinds, and then mass-producing water. And we're not using that capability. And the failure to have done that is, generating this crisis. Right?
Yeah, instead of using the fission and then just throwing away all the products, we would actually want to do the opposite. We want to create nuclear fission reactions which are primarily producing fission products. And things that, I mean, I mentioned this radioisotopes because that's sort of the limit that we've hit as far as using fission products, but we could be taking advantage of creating isotopically pure materials, which have very fine grade, in our standard at least now, fine grade properties which we can tune to. And so, for example, and literally tune to, and you know, there's been research and actually some application of cutting isotopically pure materials with their resonant, the isotope's resonant frequency lasers.
In a way like split, but to be crude.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
Or like, for example, tuned lasers can be used to set off chemical reactions without the heat, right? That's another type of example. But this whole domain of isotopically pure materials is completely neglected.
Primitive.
It's primitive.
Yeah, on purpose. I mean, it doesn't have to be.
Right, it doesn't have to be at all.
Yeah.
And we've shut down a lot of these places. Oh, for example, we had this huge fight on the fast flux test facility just 5 years back now, which was our last facility to do this type of research. But we also have not been at all investing in especially the United States on breeder reactors, which, coming back to this whole coal concept, breeder reactors can be made to breed fuel while the fission reaction is occurring, which then makes it so that, I mean, they've designed ones where the fuel can last for the entire lifetime of the plant, which means you don't have to, there's no transportation cost except for the initial building cost.
Our whole rail system grid won't have to be jammed chock full with a bunch of coal.
Right, which is what Warren Buffett is, who's the biggest rail owner in the country, is making his money off. That's just an aside back to the point about who's invested in primitive death here.
Uh-huh.
Can I ask you one thing, either one of you, before you get on to continue this and the phasing and everything? You included in your pamphlet this center in Siberia, I think it's in the Amur Valley, the Vostochny Space Center, which I guess underscores the point both of you were making about the locational aspect. I mean, Michael, you were raising about picture where you need nuclear desalination inland, and you have a map in certain parts of the Southwest. It isn't just for Arizona to have more water to grow more celery or something. We have a whole opportunity here, and that's, I presume, why you include that. But you want to say something about the Russian center, I guess, exemplifying the principle of the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good example where they've really. I haven't looked into the whole reasoning behind exactly where they put it. I'm sure there's a good reason.
This Vostochny Center is for its research and a space.
It's a cosmodrome.
Okay.
So it really is. It's, I mean, I think they argue it on the practical side, which is that you don't want to continue to rely on the current launching site. But I think they really want a science center. And they want a whole center which has not just a launching capability, but a sort of a campus setting, right, where you have a research centers right around it and educational centers and so on. And it's very near China, and we put this development route right on it.
Okay.
It's right along what we've defined previously as the world land bridge. And in this report, you'll see that Ben Dennison has drawn out the proposed sort of first phase of the land bridge, which is this arc from the United States, from the Nawapa route, up through the Bering Strait, down, passing through the Cosmodrome, and down into Korea, Japan, and China.
Yeah, well, this is something that, I mean, Russia has its own problems with monetarism, and they, you know, look at where we're going to get the money, but they're trying to figure out how to get outside that system. And this is the kind of thing we used to do with the Transcontinental Railroad, for example. There's no market benefit, blah, 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 to go out to the West in 1860. But we did it because that's the nature of the sovereign nation, is to expand, develop the resources of the territory as a whole, and manage the whole country and develop the potential of it. And that's what Russia's doing by moving out into the Siberian region and wanted to develop an actual industrial center out there, because their industry is now in Western Russia. If they're going to have all this in the East, they need a place to work from, which is what we did with the Transcontinental Railroad, right? We expanded and developed new centers. So you're constantly recreating yourself wherever you're going. And right now, this moving up with Canada, which would be a great feat we could do immediately, only 5 to 10 years it would take to complete the Alaska rail system out to the Bering Strait, from Fort Nelson to Fairbanks and Dease Lake to Fairbanks and these northern BC areas, then we'd be set up to then better complete the whole reservoir system. But all along that route, we're looking at a feat which is not as challenging as Columbus crossing the Pacific, not as challenging as the Trans-Pacific Railroad. And we should be ashamed that we haven't done this yet. Of course, we know why, I mean, politically. But that whole sector then will be an industrial corridor, which will be in a reason unto itself. It needs no justification in monetarist terms. It will create its own reason through its construction. And the cause is increasing the power of man and an alliance of sovereign nations and colonizing, developing that Arctic region in a way which will create, shockingly, a scientific corridor of research and development, one continuous integrated scientific project throughout the whole continent. And we will be pale in comparison looking back. What were you going to say? Did you have another question?
Yeah. Well, one thing is, you mentioned what you wrote in the... by the way, this pamphlet has about 9 sections. I'm just saying that, and including, let me just throw
six.
In... 6. I was counting 2 appendices in the introduction. No.
Yeah, that's true.
2 appendices in the introduction. But you mentioned phasing. You mentioned phase 1. You've done it here, too. Do you want to summarize just a bit about... I'm not talking about a recipe cookbook here, you know, I'm add these dry ingredients and these wet ones, but you have a sense of that, of what our tasks, how to look at this.
Well, it's constant evolution. You don't have to wait 40 years from now,
right,
before you get excited about the economy. Right away, as soon as we have the government intention back and put the resources into motion, we'll be applying the best that we can at the fastest rate, but designed to yield benefits throughout. So we'll be looking at different authorities. The Nawapa 21 Authority will have to get set up with a treaty. It will be the first kind of institution of its kind that I'm aware of. But internally, we can set up many institutions like Roosevelt. And the first phase, as I defined, was getting the treaty, but massively applying nuclear desalination. Just four of the Kennedy nuclear desalination projects producing 150 million gallons a day with just 1.5 gigawatts thermal. In a reactor, you have the thermal power, and then, as Leona was saying, the efficiency of the reactor, 30 to 35%, it means that you lose the rest of that heat. So you have electric and you have thermal in a reactor. Just 1.5 gigawatts of thermal could create 150 million gallons a day. Four of those would supply all of Los Angeles. Two of those would supply all of San Diego, right? So we could immediately solve and then mitigate the draining of the Colorado River. There's papers every day. 15% of the crops, irrigated crops of the nation, 4 million acres, comes from that river. And that will be, therefore, solving that while building the potential for something entirely new. Agricultural wastewater is a resource currently wasted. All along the San Joaquin Valley, the California Aqueduct, you should have nuclear desalination plants that will feed the water back in, because the water becomes less and less efficient as you go down Southern California along that aqueduct. Right now, the lake that is in Southern California, created in 1905 by an accident with the Colorado River, the name escapes me suddenly, the large lake, the Salton Sea.
Salton Sea.
That sea is a fine dumping place that it has been for agricultural wastewater, which is brackish, but yields increase the yield for the whole agricultural Imperial Valley, which everyone depends on and eats from every day. The Central Valley producing one-third of all U.S. produce, even more. That type of system has to be repaired. It's now draining because San Diego's getting the water instead of it going into that Salton Sea, which is going to become a biological disaster. And that water needs to be instead. We need more water for that region. San Diego would therefore not have to draw from that. L.A. would not have to draw from the Colorado River. So this agricultural region could continue to boom while we bring in phase two, which is the completion of the Nawapa 21, and even the elements that can start coming in a few years. Now we can have mass water for new agricultural land, as well as maintaining our agricultural land. Also, saltwater intrusion is a problem almost in every coastal city of the United States, but all along Texas, you can look at the map that we made from Houston to Corpus Christi, the California coast, Georgia, South Carolina, Florida, all of these areas, we could solve the water crisis in a couple years by building nuclear power plants. It's amazing when you look at how this is done. The very first plant of its kind, the biggest in the Western Hemisphere, the biggest on the West Coast, the first one ever, is now being built to be completed in 2016 in Carlsbad, California. But that's only producing 50 million gallons a day with a natural gas plant. That's one-third of what Kennedy wanted in 1970.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you more, and because just to continue, if you want to, in conclusion on, because you mentioned at the beginning, we're taking up to advance what was left off after Kennedy in the 1960s. Because you went back, right, to the Atomic Energy Commission from the 50s and 60s, from Kennedy's own.
Well, this was actually very exciting. I don't want to cheat the listeners today on that historical development, which was, I read through the original, 1963 Executive Office of Science and Technology task group that he formed.
Okay.
To say, tell me about large nuclear desalination plants. And under Kennedy, their report was inspirational and visionary. Under Johnson, it immediately became cost-benefit analysis garbage that shut down not only the desalination, but that shut down possible use of nuclear explosives program for excavation. It shut down the high-temperature gas cooled reactor design research. It shut down the nuclear rocket. But Kennedy's desalination program was completely different than anybody would think of today. They proposed and got a contract with a company to build an 8,300 megawatt thermal reactor. That's 8.3 gigawatts in one reactor to then generate 600 to 800 million gallons a day. So one of these plants would provide all of Los Angeles, and all of the environmentalists who are screaming and shouting could be silenced by this one plant. That would be an efficient operation. But those type of plants, and immediately they were planning to build all other kinds of things, which would have been done if Kennedy had not been assassinated, which was, of course, the reason he was assassinated, was to shut down all of his programs. So they immediately did start to try to get an interim-sized plant for 150 million gallons a day, even before the big one. And you look at their report, and it was completely optimistic. They got back to Kennedy 5 months after he was assassinated and issued their report. And the following year and the next year, that their plans began to be scaled back. But the 1966 Atomic Energy Commission report, called Nuclear Desalting, Energy for Desalting, by the Understanding the Atom series, in educating the population of the United States about the benefits of atomic energy, said that by the 80s, plants embodying several nuclear reactors as high as total capacity of 25 gigawatts could be in operation. So you're producing not only 6 gigawatts, a size enough power for about 6 to 7 million people, but also huge cities is big installation, but also 1.3 million gallons a day. So that's enough water for agriculture right there. So the integration of phase one and phase two is we do what we can in the short term while keeping our eye on the future. And as we get then the NWAPA system coming, NWAPA 21 system coming in, we're going to have an integration of those desalination of the river programs and agricultural programs, which need a lot of power. People don't realize what amount of power agriculture needs to sustain the land. Land's being abandoned because we haven't used nuclear energy. It would be a crisis, a non-existent, had we applied nuclear energy throughout agriculture, and the land would be productive. So the integration then to recycle the water quicker through, once we bring in an enormous amount of water, we're talking 100 million acre feet for the Southwest, just by taking 20% of the runoff of these rivers in the north. But we'll be able to even amplify the potential of that by having a grid of nuclear desalination throughout the West. So phase two is where we're going to bring down from the north the runoff water, which is currently wasted. And the readers can, if they've heard this before, don't think you've seen these maps. We have new detailed maps and descriptions to give you the tour, a guided tour, which I think that will really inspire you to see how this process can come alive in these different phases. So you get a sense of a building evolution of the economy, creating something entirely new, but all throughout will be immediately just bringing things alive. And that comes then to the final section of my report, is what are the industrial requirements? And that gives you a sense then of the relationship between phase one and phase two industrial requirements and everything we're going to need for these 5,400 miles of canals, 1,200 miles of tunnels, 60 dams, all the pumping stations, 52 gigawatts of nuclear power. So we're looking at 42 plants for desalination. We're looking at 28 immediate plants we need to get our capacity up at these brownfield sites. And then we need another 52 gigawatts for nuclear power to use all the water pumping. That is a bare minimum. And the American population and listeners have to think about the fact that we built 45 to 50 nuclear power plants in 10 years, in 1957 and 1967. So we can easily do what we have to do here, and that's just the bare minimum of what we need to do to start getting this evolutionary process underway. And it will require gearing up the machine tool sector and applying all of the most advanced technologies through the process. And also our foundries. We have 80% of our foundries are gone. There's three stages to industry, right? You have the mining, then you have the milling, and then you have the foundries. And all, the most advanced part of it is always at the end, and all of that's overseas. 80% of it's gone. So returning these kind of things, but with new technologies and robotics and other things, we will create an entirely new industrialization. And, well, you don't want to miss out on it, let me tell you.
No, that. And that's, I guess, the time has zipped by. And so I want to thank you for presenting all this, Leona Fancheng and Michael Kirsch, and encourage everyone, be sure, and you can go on the 21st Century Science and Technology site, but go on LaRouchePack.com, and you can download this new report, Nuclear NWAPA 21 Gateway to the Fusion Economy. So this is September 7th, 2013. It's the end of the LaRouche Show for this week. Marcia Mary Baker signing off. Thank you very much. This is the thermonuclear future.
Thank you.